From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling charges another state trooper and suggests the fallout from the overtime scandal isn't over.
It appears necessary from what we've seen so far to clean house a little bit at the state police.
Also today, gas restoration in the Merrimack Valley is nearly complete, but there's more work to come.
As a community, I think we're trying our best, but the effects of the gas crisis are much greater than any of us ever anticipated.
And what Bob Cousy wishes he could have done for Celtics teammate Bill Russell.
At the end of the day, when you're sitting reviewing your life, you have a lot of regrets as to how you could have done things better.
Plus, how Massachusetts companies are working on alternatives to that most local of fishes.
Codfish. Beautiful codfish.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. An 8th Massachusetts state trooper has been charged in the unfolding overtime pay scandal. U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling dropped that news today, just before convening a reporters' roundtable to talk more broadly about his first year on the job. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker was at the table, and she joins us now. Hi, Deb.
Hi there. So how are you today?
I'm very well. And let's start with the state police. It's both the news of the day, and it's also been a big part of Lelling's tenure so far. So what did he have to say?
Well, that was the first question to U.S. Attorney Lelling, was to comment about today's news that another state trooper was charged in this overtime investigation. Also, we heard today that two troopers who are facing charges agreed to plead guilty, and another trooper was set to formally admit his guilt. But the trooper charged today is 40-year-old Heath McAuliffe. He's being arraigned in federal court at this hour. And U.S. Attorney Lelling said the investigation by his office into the Massachusetts State Police is ongoing. Here's a bit of what he said.
It appears necessary from what we've seen so far to clean house a little bit at the state police. So we are going to keep investigating the use of overtime at the state police while we have leads.
And Callum, he also said that he's hoping for a thorough yet speedy investigation so state police in Massachusetts can move on.
Yeah, speedy, but it doesn't sound like he's done,
no, perhaps.
What else did he say would be main priorities for 2019?
I think he said, hands down, the opioid epidemic is his main priority. Lelling said he's working on this on several fronts. He made his first public comments today during this reporters' roundtable since he sent letters to Massachusetts doctors recently warning them about their opioid prescribing. He said his office sent letters to doctors whose prescribing habits were flagged after an analysis of state and federal data. And when he was asked to specify that today, he said he couldn't specify the type of data, but he said if someone had overdosed within 60 days after receiving a prescription for opioids, that doctor was sent a letter. Here's a bit more of what he said.
The point of the letters was essentially to use the authority of my office to remind prescribers that they need to be very careful with what is, in this day and age, literally a deadly substance.
And Lelling also said, Callum, that any sort of marijuana enforcement, because although recreational marijuana is now legal in Massachusetts, he said it is still legal, illegal under federal law.
Right.
He said he would take a back seat to enforcing marijuana laws because fighting the opioid epidemic is more important. Although he did say he would review certain crimes related to marijuana if they were particularly egregious. But the interesting thing, Cal, that he said was that he's focusing on the city of Lawrence. He mentioned Lawrence several times during this reporter roundtable, and he said expect enforcement action there because of the opioid epidemic and other things. And he said he wants to make it uncomfortable in Lawrence. And of course, immigration came up during this roundtable, and he was asked about that, and he said, you know, I see no problem using immigration laws sometimes when I'm doing a drug investigation because it can be faster than using a criminal proceeding to try to remove drug activity from a community like Lawrence. Let's listen.
So if you want to stop Lawrence from being a locus of this activity, I mean, Lawrence basically straddles 93 and then 495 to 95, you need to make it uncomfortable. And using the immigration laws is a good way to make it uncomfortable for those drug dealers who happen to also be here illegally.
And Lelling also said he's going to use immigration laws to fight gangs. And he said the MS-13 gang has pretty much been eradicated in Massachusetts.
A bold assertion there, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's been another big immigration story in the news lately. Just last week, the Boston Globe reported that a Newton district court judge may have been involved in helping a man leave a courthouse and evade immigration officials. We still don't know exactly how that played out, but did Lelling address that? It's reported that he's formed a grand jury to investigate, but I understand he didn't confirm or deny that.
Well, he was asked about it. He won't confirm an investigation, as is typical for law enforcement officials. He did say that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has its own guidelines, and he said ICE is not often arresting people in courtrooms, but when it does happen, it gets highly publicized. U.S. Attorney Lelling also said he has no problem with immigration officials being in the courts to arrest people who have criminal charges and are in the country illegally. He did not, as I said, say anything specific about this judge in Newton. This is what he said.
I have no plans to prosecute judges. I'll say this. The ICE agents who are enforcing the immigration laws, they're enforcing a federal law. And so if you don't like that federal law, change the law. But until that happens, members of the executive branch, prosecutors, agents, they're going to enforce that law. And as a corollary to that, if you obstruct what they're doing, you're committing a federal crime because you were obstructing enforcement of a federal law.
Also, he was asked if he thought that this would be having a chilling effect on people. And he said, nope, he doesn't think it is having that kind of an effect on people cooperating with law enforcement because of any deportation fears.
And obviously, immigration enforcement is a priority of this Trump administration, the president who put Lelling in this job. Mm-hmm. And there's more news out of Washington. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said just yesterday that the Senate will vote on a new federal criminal justice reform bill. Did Lelling talk about that, how the federal bill could affect his work here in Massachusetts?
He said his office has been following this legislation very closely because, as he put it, it would change the landscape, particularly in areas such as reducing mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug crimes. Here's Lelling again.
I think the biggest change under the bill as currently written would be its impact on what they call truth in sentencing in federal court. Generally speaking, if you get 5 years in federal court, you're going to serve pretty much 5 years. The new law, if it's passed, would change that sum by increasing the availability of reductions in sentences for people in jail who participate in rehabilitation and reentry type initiatives.
Essentially, Cal, Lelling said if the president supports this legislation, I support it. He also reflected a bit on his first year in office, which was the point, really, of today's roundtable. And he was asked about how the turbulence in Washington has been affecting the office. And he said he thinks morale is good. He said productivity's up 30% over the last fiscal year. Of course, folks said, how do you know? How do you measure productivity? And he said that's based on the number of indictments. He also said he's hired 21 new federal prosecutors just in the Boston office this year, which is the most the office has ever hired. So all in all, he said good, but he did admit that it would be nice to have a permanent federal U.S. Attorney General in place.
And he said he likes Bill Barr for
the job. And he did say that.
That is WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker. Deb, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Significant accomplishment, but mission not complete. That was the word from Governor Baker at a news conference this afternoon, talking about the restoration work in the Merrimack Valley following those September gas explosions and fires, which left about 8,400 homes and businesses without gas or hot water. Governor Baker thanked the community for its patience and the contractors for their hard work and said his administration is not taking its eye off the ball.
Our administration and these municipal leaders will continue to hold Columbia Gas accountable for this mission until the folks are made whole and returned to normalcy. That being said, it's important to note we've come a long way.
WBUR reporter Quincy Walters was at that news conference in Loras, and he joins us now from there. Quincy, hello.
Hey, Callum.
So what did you hear from the governor today and Columbia Gas representatives who also spoke? What was their main message?
So their main message was that a milestone has been reached. 98% of homes have been restored, over 18,000 pieces of equipment and appliances installed, 2,200 families were provided temporary housing, and the bulk of them are returning home. They said alternative housing like hotels and trailers are being emptied out, and the hope is that the last camping trailer will be rolled out very soon. But Governor Baker says, as you mentioned earlier, that people want to hold Columbia Gas accountable.
We expect Columbia Gas to keep working with the mayor and the town managers on every aspect of this operation to support the residents of the Commonwealth who were put through this dire situation through no fault of their own.
And the governor and the town managers and mayor of the area said that this is a mission not accomplished yet.
So if there's still a lot of work left to do, Quincy, once gas is fully restored, what else is left to do from the community's perspective? What are they looking for?
Right. So there are still about 9,000 claims that are outstanding. There will be claim centers in the three towns, and they'll also have to deal with streetscapes and lawns because a lot of them had to be uprooted to redo the piping infrastructure underground, and boilers will be replaced, are planning to be replaced in the spring. Reverend Dana Allen Walsh of North Andover said the people she knows are still having problems.
I know Columbia Gas has been working tremendously hard to restore gas to people, especially in this cold weather. But, you know, one of the things I have seen is that even once gas is restored in a family's house, but there can still be issues like the new dryer that Columbia Gas installed isn't functioning properly, and the warranty ran out because it took Columbia Gas so long to get their gas restored.
And Governor Baker kind of addressed that in the press conference today, saying that Columbia Gas and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have a significant presence in the region until everything is back to normal.
You know, Quincy, we heard from state lawmakers yesterday saying they were concerned about natural gas companies in Massachusetts possibly compromising safety by turning to outside contractors for their pipeline work. Did you hear any concern today that and a disaster like this could actually happen again in the future?
Yeah, Callum. Governor Baker was asked, you know, what of the people who are concerned that, you know, they return home and they're afraid to turn on, you know, their gas or their heat? And Baker said that the hardest part is that the memories of the September explosions are still fresh. Linda Harvey, chair of Debbie's Treasure Chest, an organization that provides clothing, toys and toiletries to at-risk families in the Merrimack Valley, says she still has lingering questions that keep her up at night.
Who pays the mental health counseling? Who pays the physical counseling? How long is Columbia Gas going to be around to really help us?
And once again, Baker sort of addressed that in the press conference today, saying that the most assurance he can give people is that the trained professionals have been involved in the recovery effort.
That's WBUR reporter Quincy Walters in Lawrence. Quincy, thanks again.
Thanks, Callum.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Massachusetts is home to the nation's number one fishing port. More than $300 million worth of seafood lands in New Bedford every year. But the kind of seafood is changing. Rising ocean temperatures are driving southern fish species into New England's waters. And local staples like cod are subject to strict catch limits. In response, local researchers are developing artificial intelligence to promote smarter fishing. And private companies are working on alternatives, including bioengineered fish and even fish flesh grown in laboratories. As part of WBUR's series Lab to Table, The Future of Our Food, I looked at what may come next from the sea, or perhaps from an indoor tank or a test tube.
This barrel is a 6-foot diameter barrel, and inside it we put these cameras.
Danny Eilertson pauses a tour of his recently renovated scalloping boat to pull up a video clip on his smartphone. The third-generation fisherman explains that the footage is from a trip where he submerged this camera-equipped barrel and dragged it through the Gulf of Maine. The barrel is open at both ends, so fish can pass through.
What are we seeing here? I can't.
Codfish. Beautiful codfish.
So this is the cod in.
Eilertson's trained eye identifies fish species right away, and in a lab in New Bedford, researchers led by UMass Dartmouth's Kevin Stokesbury are teaching a computer to do the same thing using video shot from Eilertson's boat.
Right now we're at the point where we can identify flatfish, roundfish, and others, and eventually we hope it can run and count the fish in real time.
This is machine learning in process, that you are teaching the machine how to recognize.
That's right, yeah, and it's fairly labor intensive.
Stokesbury says his team will need thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of samples of each species before the computer can reliably identify them. If they work, underwater cameras and artificial intelligence could help solve a long-standing problem. Because they can't see underwater, fishermen invariably catch protected species in their dragnets. Ed Washburn says this hurts the bottom line. He's the New Bedford Port Authority's executive director.
You're targeting haddock, but if you catch too much cod, you have to stop fishing.
You can't sort it out? You can't just throw the cod back or something?
No. So if it comes onto the deck and there's observers on board, there's an assumption that it won't survive even if you throw it back.
Those onboard observers are from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which enforces catch limits. NOAA says it's interested in a smart underwater eye because it could enhance conservation efforts. But AI isn't the only kind of high-tech project in the works.
Here at Aqua Bounty Technologies, we specialize in the production of environmentally sustainable, high-quality seafood.
Maynard-based Aqua Bounty has genetically modified an Atlantic salmon using genes from the larger Chinook salmon and the ocean pout eel. The resulting fish can grow to market weight in 18 months, about half the time of a wild salmon. Aqua Bounty produces fish in indoor tanks in Panama, where regulations are looser, and it's been selling GMO salmon in Canada for a couple of years. Almost three decades after its founding, Aqua Bounty says it's close to selling its first fish in the U.S. Chief Executive Ron Stottish says his company's product is necessary.
We've overfished our oceans. So as our population grows by another billion or so people in the next 20 years, how are we going to feed them? I'm not saying we're going to feed them all with salmon, but we have to find a better way to meet those needs by using technology that can help us produce the foods of the future.
Aqua Bounty has FDA approval and an indoor farming facility ready to go in Indiana. But to begin operations there, the company would need to import its genetically modified salmon eggs. It can't, because Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski attached a ban on such imports to this year's federal spending bill. Here's Murkowski at a congressional hearing.
We refer to this GE salmon as Frankenfish. The valid question and concern is whether or not this fish should even be called a salmon. And there's great fear that lies with these mutated fish that have not...
Aqua Bounty's Stottish calls the senator's position almost un-American. He says he's confident Congress will ultimately lift the ban. If it does, Aqua Bounty would still face the challenge of convincing supermarkets to carry the fish and convincing consumers to eat it. Stottish says the company aims to win over the environmentally conscious, eat local crowd.
Today, salmon are produced in cold water regions of the world, such as the fjords of Norway or the protected coast of southern Chile. And then those fish have to be transported great distances. So this represents a tremendous opportunity to produce an environmentally sustainable product closer to the consumer.
This pitch sounds a lot like what companies developing cultured meat are saying. They're working on beef, chicken, and fish assembled from cell cultures in a laboratory. No slaughtering necessary. Investors include some of the biggest names in the food industry, like Tyson and Cargill. One Israeli startup claims it's on track to lower the cost of lab-grown beef and chicken to a point where it'll be competitive with the natural stuff in 2020. Lab-grown seafood is farther behind. When a Silicon Valley startup called Finless Foods staged a small-scale tasting of lab-grown carp last year, the production cost was about $19,000 a pound.
It is not very close to your table.
Ben Wergoft is a visiting scholar at MIT and is writing a book about cultured meat. He says the promises of cultured meat sound good, but he's skeptical of what he calls the hype machine around the technology.
Most cultured meat startups may have the ultimate goal of removing things about industrial animal ag that we all think are unhealthy, morally reprehensible, unsustainable environmentally, but they also have more immediate needs, like making money.
In Duxbury Bay, Island Creek oyster farm owner Skip Bennett pays attention to seafood technology, too. In fact, the onshore hatchery where his shellfish begin their lives resembles a science lab, with tanks of fluorescent algae carefully analyzed to ensure they meet the baby oyster's nutritional needs. Bennett says the farm will begin a partnership with UMass Boston next year, equipping a buoy with sensors to monitor water temperature and acidity.
Well, we know things are going to change, whether that's climate change or impacts of acidification. So we really need a baseline now so that in the future we can make adjustments to meet those changes.
Adjustments will be key to the future of Island Creek's business, but to Bennett, the future of seafood more broadly comes down to this.
Whatever's caught local and it's really abundant. 2 weeks ago, I caught mackerel off our dock down here. I brought them home and cooked them, and they're just phenomenal. And, you know, and then in the summer, striped bass, they've rebounded incredibly, and it's just a great resource, well-managed.
As scientists and startups invent ways for diners to keep eating familiar fish, seafood lovers may also have to learn to love whatever the new catch of the day might be. And you can find the rest of our series, Lab to Table, The Future of Our Food, at our website, WBUR.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers.
At the end of the day, when you're sitting reviewing your life, you have a lot of regrets as to how you should have, could have done things better.
That's the voice of Bob Cousy, Basketball Hall of Famer. On the court, it's kind of hard to imagine how he could have done much better. He was team captain for the first six Boston Celtics titles. But lately, Cousy has been thinking a lot about his relationship with former teammate Bill Russell.
I felt some guilt over not reaching out to him, and that's what I did eventually.
WBUR Only a Game producer and reporter Gary Wallach brings us this story.
On a cold autumn morning, Bob Cousy greets me at the front door as the leaves fall around his home in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's lived there alone since his wife died 5 years ago. I shake his hand and ask him how he's doing. "Never ask a 90-year-old that question," he says. He brandishes his cane for emphasis. We sit at his enormous dining room table and talk about his early days on the Celtics. His hands move like he's throwing passes to invisible teammates as he discusses his rookie year.
"Well, we had some talented players. We had some not-so-talented players."
Cousy says that his fellow rookie, Chuck Cooper, was a 5 or 6 on a 10 scale, talent-wise. But Cooper was something else.
"Jackie Robinson broke the color line in baseball in 1947. 3 years later, our owner, Walter Brown, got up at the meeting and said, 'The Celtics draft Chuck Cooper from Duquesne.'"
Cousy had no black friends growing up in a Manhattan tenement. He had no black teammates in high school or college. Now he was roommates with the first black player selected in the NBA draft. They went to movies, listened to jazz, and drank at bars. Their bond was tested on February 28, 1952, after a game in Raleigh.
"And he wasn't allowed to register in a hotel with us. And Chuck and I somehow found out that there was a sleeper going through Raleigh that night at 12:30 to New York with a connection to Boston."
Cousy and Cooper went to Union Station to wait for the sleeper train.
"We start drinking beer. And after three or four beers, it's like midnight. And we have to go whiz."
They made their way to the restroom. Cousy was unprepared for what he saw.
"Stupid signs, big white signs with a black arrow. One pointing right says colored, the other pointing left says white. And I was stunned. I was ashamed to be white. I didn't know what to say to him. I said, 'Come on, let's go out.' We go out to the end of the platform and we peed together."
Their friendship grew off the court and on it. Cooper was a good player, but Cousy, a point guard, was beginning to transform the league.
This is the 1950s, and he's a little bit like Elvis Presley in music or James Dean in film.
That's writer Gary Pomerantz. He's interviewed Cousy over 50 times.
"He's a renegade, pushing out against the conservative norms, dribbling behind his back and throwing no-look passes. He was adding sort of a jolt of caffeine to the NBA, a jolt of style."
But the Celts were only slightly better than mediocre.
"They were a team struggling to find itself. The Celtics needed a big man to make it to the next level."
In a trade after the 1956 draft, the Celtics acquired center Bill Russell.
"Russ changed the dynamic in every way.
He was a fearsome shot blocker.
He put a trauma on opposing shooters.
And he was a great rebounder.
An opponent would take a shot and miss, and there's Russell rising, 6'10", long, lean, and springy, getting the rebound, and half-turning and snap-passing the outlet to Cousy.
Russell and Cousy created a fast-break style that was nearly indefensible.
These are, in many ways, the ultimate teammates. they were both murderously competitive. And very quickly, the Celtics emerged as a force to be reckoned with.
Russell and Kuz had a relatively tight relationship on the court.
That's forward Satch Sanders. He joined the Celtics in 1960.
They had a lot of respect for each other. That was clear. Off the court, they were not spending a lot of time in each other's company.
Racial tensions were high in the U.S. That carried over into some NBA locker rooms. But Sanders says that wasn't the case with the Celtics. Cousy says Red Auerbach, who he alone called by his first name, Arnold, created clubhouse harmony in a rather unusual way.
I think Arnold, frankly, solved the black-white situation pretty well. He treated everyone the same, badly. You know? So Russ and I's relationship was the same as any two people that are working towards a goal.
The goal was to win championships. And with Russell, the Celtics began to do that. But something else was happening at the outset of the Celtics dynasty. Gary Pomerantz.
Russell and Cousy were together for 7 years as teammates. And if you put that on the civil rights timeline, it's roughly from the end of the Montgomery bus boycott to Dr. King's March on Washington address in 1963. That is the heart of the black freedom struggle. And Russell would engage in that struggle in a way that few athletes did.
On October 17th, 1961, the Celtics played a preseason exhibition game in Lexington, Kentucky. Satch Sanders remembers what happened at the team hotel before the game.
We had gone downstairs to eat, and they said, well, we really can't serve you people.
They weren't happy about it, and they gathered in Russell's room of the hotel.
Russell and Sanders, along with Casey Jones and Sam Jones, decided not to play.
And Red didn't want to turn away from a nice payday for the team. So he tried to convince the African-American Celtics to stay. And Russell said, we're going home.
The white players gave it consideration, but in the end, they decided to play the game.
7 white Celtics played, including Bob Cousy, who didn't protest.
I have no explanation for this. Feeling, as I do, about social justice, being a captain of the team.
When Gary Pomerantz originally asked Cousy about the game, he said he didn't remember it.
Cousy said, why did I play? What was I thinking? It was an exhibition game. Why didn't I say something? I think he was so focused on being Bob Cousy, some of the most essential American history of the second half of the century, passed him by, went over his head. He was focused on winning. He was focused on his endorsements and his brand. And it just went by.
Meanwhile, Bill Russell spoke more and more publicly about civil rights and the treatment of African Americans. He called Boston a racist city. The press went to Russell for quotes, but
they didn't like him because he exuded arrogance, confidence, and all the other things that black guys should not have in a lot of estimations.
In 1963, someone broke into Bill Russell's home, scrawled insults on the walls, and defecated in his bed. Russell wore his anger even more prominently on his sleeve.
Russ was the ultimate angry black man. And I didn't blame him then, and I blame him even less now.
Cousy says it pained him to watch African Americans struggle for acceptance and inclusion. But he remained quiet. And Cousy says Russell's anger made it hard for them to form a friendship like the ones Cousy had enjoyed with Chuck Cooper and some of his other black teammates.
Let's go have a beer, let's go to the movie together, whatever. We'll socialize outside of the unit. I was a senior member. I had a good relationship with the media, I always have. So I could have reached out and perhaps shared his pain a little bit with him, you know. I never did that with Russ.
Bob Cousy retired at the end of the 62-63 season, after yet another successful title run. He and Russell had led the Celtics to 6 NBA championships in their 7 seasons together. The Celtics gathered for a postseason dinner.
And Bill Russell took to the podium to speak. And what Russell said was, you meet very few men in life like Bob Cousy. I consider Cousy like a brother. And Russell became emotional at this point.
Cousy doesn't really remember that either.
Obviously, this should have been special to me. When I read what he said, it brought back a slight memory, and it brought a tear to my eye, but I don't know why I don't remember it more specifically, other than I'm 90 freaking years old. That's something to do with it, you know.
When I read these quotes to Cousy during an interview, Cousy just started shaking his head. He said, "What was I thinking? Why didn't I get up and go across the room and give Russ a hug?"
In the fall of 1963, the Celtics became Bill Russell's team, unless that had happened much earlier. Russell retired as a player in 1969. After 13 seasons in the NBA, he had earned 11 championship rings. Cousy did a lot of thinking over three decades about how he'd fallen short as a team leader. But he didn't talk about it until a 2001 ESPN interview about Russell.
And he was talking in a breezy way about Russell's extraordinary athleticism. But the topic shifted to race.
Well, I should have been much more sensitive to Russell's anguish in those days.
And he just broke down sobbing. He buried his head in his hands on camera.
A couple months later, Cousy attended a charity golf event in Florida. Russell, who had seen Cousy's ESPN interview, was there too, and Cousy had no idea what to expect.
Russ and I always said over the years, had kind of a love-hate relationship. And he'd either kind of ignore me or glare at me, or in this case, he ran over and threw his arms around me, and we talked about this first meaningful conversation we probably ever had in our relationship. And he basically said, "Cous, whatever you might have done wouldn't have been helpful." He said what he had to do to make me feel better, I guess. And I appreciated that.
And he hoped this conversation would lead to a higher ground in their relationship, a deeper friendship. But it really didn't.
I thought about it for 15 to 16 years, and I wrote him a letter 3 years ago, pretty much doing a mea culpa.
Cousy hand-wrote that letter.
And I basically said, "Russ, I know we've never been pen pals, and I'm sorry about that. It was my responsibility to reach out to you and hopefully share the pain that you had during that period, or minimize it, or whatever. However, I didn't do that. Sorry about that." And that was it.
Well, then 6 months passed without a response, and then a year, and then 2 years, and then 2.5 years later, in August of this year, 2018, Cousy got a call on a Sunday night at home. It was an old, somewhat enfeebled voice saying, "Bob, it's Bill Russell. I'm calling to see how you are." They talked for about 10 or 12 minutes, according to Cousy. And then he asked the question, "Russ, I sent you a letter a couple years ago. Did you get it?" And Bill Russell said, "Yes, I did. Thank you." Nothing more.
Was Russell's response brief because he was angry? Not angry at all? Cousy wouldn't speculate. I asked him if Bill Russell's simple response of yes was sufficient.
Yes, absolutely.
For 3 seasons, Satch Sanders observed the relationship between Bob Cousy and Bill Russell up close. I ask him if he thinks Cousy owed Russell an apology.
No, I don't think Cousy owed him an apology. But I do think that Cousy, because he was Cousy, thought he could do more. And then started thinking that he should have done more. Because he's a man of conscience and sensitive. Could he have done more? Possibly. But he feels he could do more, and that's what really counts.
I do a lot of meditating these days, thinking about the old days, but I notice I blank out the negatives as much as I can, and I focus on the positives.
When our conversation is over, Bob Cousy shows me to the door. Audemer rushes in as he retrieves a plate of food a neighbor covered in tinfoil and left for him on the front step. I say goodbye and shake his hand, the one that threw so many perfect passes to his teammates, the one that held the pen as he wrote a letter to Bill Russell.
WBUR Only a Game producer and reporter, Gary Wallach. And by the way, Gary Pomerantz's new book is The Last Pass: Cousy, Russell, the Celtics, and What Matters in the End.